Hello and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. The president's policies on refugee immigration and travel are being tested in the lawsuit to stop his executive order, now with Hawaii versus Trump on pause, pending the results of a federalist government appeal of the injunction. Where does that leave families and individuals already caught in the system? And what of the push for sanctuary resolutions? Immigration attorney Claire Hannes is already working on behalf of a Maui woman set for deportation. She says the Venegas case could be the beginning of Trump's immigration policy in Hawaii. Claire Hannes is in our studio with us today. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks. Nice to be here.
There is so much swirling around the issues of immigration, immigration policy, the travel ban, all of that, that it's easy to conflate many of those things. As you now look at this sort of strange little place that we're in now, where you're already working with certain clients, clearly the one that we've been talking about that's been much in the news this week, as well as what we may see happening a month hence, where is that leaving a lot of these families who are already moving through the system or potentially at risk? And also when they hear about issues of creating sanctuaries potentially, or what that might mean with some of the resolutions that we've seen put forth.
Right. There is a lot to unpack. And I think it's important to remember that when we talk about immigration policy and President Trump's executive orders and how that's affecting us here on the ground, that there were actually three separate executive orders that were issued in January related to immigration. And they're connected, but they're also in some ways very separate and distinct. We have the memo on interior enforcement that talks about sanctuary jurisdictions and could have potentially a larger impact on our local community. And then on January 22nd, he came out with two executive orders, one related to the travel ban and one related to border security and the kind of build the wall movement. So while the travel ban works its way again through the courts, we have the issue of interior enforcement, and that's what those of us who work with local immigrant communities are really concerned about, how the agenda of the Trump administration, which has kind of sent mixed messages about how it's going to treat kind of people without criminal histories, parents, DACA recipients, which are people who were brought to the United States as children,
the
and
dreamers.
Have the dreamers, and now have a kind of temporary reprieve from deportation, although it's not a legal status. It's very interesting, kind of location by location, state by state, and Immigration Customs Enforcement district by district, how individuals within the system are being treated. And so we had a case yesterday where there was a mother of three from Maui who was scheduled to report for deportation, despite the fact that she had her case is still open in the immigration court system. There's an appeal pending at the Board of Immigration Appeals. And this for me was sort of a test case, whether or not local immigration customs enforcement officials were going to take a very heavy-handed approach to her case, or whether they were going to, as they've often done in before, kind of balance the equities and decide, looking at the equities, whether she's a flight risk or a danger to society, whether they would release her. Thankfully, she was released. So that's an encouraging sign for those of us working locally. Another issue that's being looked at very and worked on very proactively by local immigration advocates are resolutions going through the city council right now, and also through the state legislature, two different resolutions that talk about Hawaii as a welcoming place, basically a pushback against the Trump administration agenda, which is kind of divide and conquer immigrant communities.
But that agenda also had with it some purse strings.
Right. And so this was also part of the executive order that was issued on January 25th, and specifically talks about sanctuary jurisdictions, which, again, sanctuary jurisdictions doesn't mean that anyone living within one of these areas or communities is protected from from anything, any kind of immigration enforcement. But it generally means that local jurisdictions will not cooperate with an immigration agenda. They will not act as immigration enforcement.
So are those jurisdictions, including Hawaii, that are not actively cooperating in real jeopardy of losing federal funding?
We don't know. It's interesting. There are agreements. There are only nationwide right now 37 counties or areas that have affirmative law enforcement relationships with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Compare those 37 to 4 states, 39 cities, and 364 counties nationwide who have said, we are not going to enforce immigration law. We are not going to have our local police acting as immigration agents. So there's a lot of pushback nationwide by states as large as California and then some smaller states. And so mayors have come out very strongly saying if they're federal funding is jeopardized based on their decisions not to enforce immigration laws by their own law enforcement officials, they will challenge that in the court. They feel very strongly that that's unconstitutional. So if Hawaii goes along as declaring itself as a state or as counties not enforcing immigration laws, we're in very good company. With other states and municipalities that are also pushing back.
As all this is happening at both the state and city and county levels, where does that leave, though, the families who are looking at these letters that they find threatening to their very being here, similar to the case of the woman that we've been talking about the past couple of days? How do you look at some of this with these people and try to maybe mitigate what they're being told and how they're being told about their status?
Right. Well, when people have exhausted most of their administrative appeals and are kind of towards the end of the line in the court system, again, Immigration and Customs Enforcement will often issue these letters to either report in regularly, say every 6 months or a year, just to keep tabs on where people are, or to report for deportation. In some places across the United States, people have been so afraid to report, who have reported generally before, that they are seeking sanctuary within churches. And so local churches here in Hawaii are actively discussing whether or not they will open their doors to sanctuary for these families. And actually for this mother, that's something that I discussed with her.
We talked about that on the show when we were looking at what St. Elizabeth's Church was
right.
choosing to do, and they've been spearheading that with Reverend Gerlach. But beyond just the sanctuary and of the long-time held sanctuary within churches or other houses of worship, what goes on with some of these people now? What should they be doing? Are they feeling heartened by the fact that there's so much happening that may drastically affect their position?
I think people are... people who are in this situation are definitely encouraged by the amount of community support that has come out to rally with them and their causes. I think people who were feeling very isolated and alone will hopefully feel a little less alone and know that as they try to work through in their own head their options, they have people who, attorneys and advocates on almost all the islands who are available to call for assistance. And that if they need community support, if they need, we had a number of pastors who came out yesterday, even if people need help as far as, say, paying a bond so that they can get out and be with their families, there were people who were willing to come forward and actually open their wallets and pay for that. So I think that represents kind of the best of Hawaii as a welcoming place. And I think that's an important message for immigrants to know and for law enforcement, immigration enforcement to know that they're not operating in a vacuum.
Some real heartening words there and a sense of aloha that we don't really hear about all that much until it's truly challenged in this way. Well, we're going to hope for the best for Mrs. Venegas, and we'll hear more from you as we move through this and wait to see what happens with the Hawaii versus Trump appeal.
Thank you
so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Claire Hannes is an immigration attorney at Damon Key Leung Kupchak and Hastert in Honolulu and is a founding member of the Hawaii Coalition for Immigration Reform.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a longtime surfing star learns to snowboard. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're remembering a former territorial governor who gave much of his life to the care of Hawaii's Hansen's disease patients. He came from a Kama'aina missionary family. His grandfather had been sent to the islands in the early 19th century by the American Board of Missions and later served as advisor to Kamehameha III. He was educated at Punahou and at Hotchkiss School in Connecticut and worked for two Big Five companies, Alexander & Baldwin and Theo Davies, before serving in the First World War. In 1929, he was appointed as territorial governor by President Herbert Hoover, serving in the office until 1934. While in office, he took particular interest in the care of patients at Kalaupapa on Molokai, an interest he traced to a childhood incident when he had seen people taken away to a life of confinement at the settlement. This morning, we're looking for his name, and if you know it, we want to hear from you, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're first and right, you get the prize.
Aloha, I'm William Finnegan from The New Yorker magazine. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Jerry Lopez is one of the legends of big wave surfing, adept at shifting his weight to harness the power of gigantic ocean swells beneath him. His skills gave him a leg up when he took on a new sport, snowboarding. He fell in love with it to the point where he's created a snowboarding event in Oregon called the Jerry Lopez Big Wave Challenge. We spoke with him about his new passion and how it came into his life.
Well, you know, it's a lot like surfing. I went one time, it was actually my wife's idea, and she loves to tell the story about how I stood there and, yeah, another one of your big ideas. But for actually both of us, it was one of those things that, you know, it was love at first bite. And in fact, we ended up moving lock, stock, and barrel. Well, you know, it was a process of several years from Maui to Oregon here so that we could snowboard more.
I would imagine the first thing that was strange about it was that the surface is not moving beneath you, right?
Well, that's actually one of the great things about it. You know, after a lifetime in the ocean chasing waves, that's really one of the beauties about snowboarding is that the mountain holds still for you while, you know, you take your ride. Out there in the ocean, everything's moving.
And when you're on the ocean, you've got to have a sort of a human springboard ready to move with it, right? I would think that would be a big adjustment.
Well, you know, that's why surfing is such a great metaphor for life, because life doesn't hold still for us either. And all the things you learn out in the surf, trying to be, as you say, spontaneous, you know, and moving with it is just what you have to do with life, too. And if you don't, it just passes you right by.
Yeah, that's a few would disagree with that, Jerry. At the same time, you know, I would think that whole sort of resilience that you need for surfing would be quite a bit of an adaptation when you don't have to move with the surface. Is it a lot easier then?
In some ways it is, but, you know, there are all the little things about snowboarding and the snow and the mountains that need to be learned again. So there's you know, nothing easy about anything in life. Mm-hmm. It's all a process.
How long did it take you to learn, you to get comfortable snowboarding?
Well, let's put it this way. I brought one of my surf team riders up, you know, one of the really hotshot young surfers, and he learned, I mean, really learned in about an hour. It took me quite a bit longer than he did, but snowboarding compared to surfing is something that most surfers, you know, when they first try it, discover that it's actually something that comes very naturally, and they are able to pick it up pretty quickly, at least pick it up to the level where they're having a good time doing it.
Mm-hmm. Are the competitors in events like your Big Wave Challenge, do they come from surfing, or are they lifelong snowboarders, native snowboarders, if you will?
Well, here in Oregon, most of the people that live here are, you know, winter enthusiasts who embrace the snow. And, yeah, a lot of them are hotshot snowboarders. So this is the reason that we have what I call a pro surfer division in our event, where we can get the surfers, you know, hopefully from Hawaii or anywhere, mm-hmm. to come. And they may not be, you know, totally comfortable and maybe feel a little bit out of their element. So they have their own division, and they can just go against the other surfers and not be intimidated by guys who have spent the whole winter chasing the snow.
Yeah. Are there a lot of surfers adapting to snowboarding?
I think all surfers at some point give it a try.
Really?
They do, yeah, because they hear so often, you know, and I'm one of the big advocates of it, that it really, especially in powder snow, is so much like surfing. And the whole idea of this event, well, it came about because, you know, the wind blows the snow and creates these snow features that we call wind lips that look just like waves on the ocean, except they're frozen, you know. They're, mm-hmm. They're made out of snow. And they kind of happen in the same places on the mountain. And so I've named a lot of them after, you know, surf spots that I'm familiar with. And I was talking with, then he was the marketing director of the Mount Bachelor ski area here, and he goes, well, we should have an event that's kind of like a snow surfing event, you know, and we kind of brainstormed it a little bit and came up with this idea that, well, we could build waves out of snow and judge it like a surf contest.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we have.
As a surfer, you were pretty familiar with the challenges, the particular challenges of huge waves, right?
Well, I like them all, but yeah, bigger waves are always a little more challenging, and I think I really like those better.
Well, you know, to the novice, it looks like somebody, you know, roller skating down a two-story building or something, and I'm wondering how you duplicate that on snow.
Well, you get on a big slope and imagine that it's a wave that's holding still for you, and away you go.
And in a way that you probably, at various times over your career, might have wished that some of those waves would hold still, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, they never do they?
Well, apparently not. But so a lot of the designs sort of came out of your own experience as a surfer. It sounds like the way you designed the course on Mount Bachelor.
Yeah, and we name each of the features that we build after a surf spot, you know, surf spots that I'm familiar with or that I wish I was familiar with, you know, just from seeing pictures of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of, you know, adds a little more of a surf element to this snow event.
Well, Jerry, how has your cold weather adaptation been? That's something people from Hawaii are always concerned about.
Well, I tell you what, I think you can be dressed warmly, more warmly in any of the snow conditions than you ever can in the surf conditions. And I think I've been more cold and miserable surfing in Hawaii on a north wind day than I've ever been up on the mountain.
Jerry Lopez is the originator of the Jerry Lopez Big Wave Challenge, which is being held this weekend at Mount Bachelor in Bend, Oregon.
Support for today's programming comes from Chamber Music Hawaii. The CMH Trace-Ensemble performs music of Dvorak and Beethoven, April 10th at Palikū Theater and on the 24th at Doris Duke Theater. ChamberMusicHawaii.org.
Last month, Lieutenant Governor Sean Tsutsui said he was considering resigning to run for Maui mayor. Now, if that happens, how Hawaii's power structure could be rearranged is today's reality check with CivilBeat.org reporter Chad Blair. Hey there, Chad.
Back again. Thanks.
Back again. And looking at something that, on one hand, you think about, okay, a man's got to look after his political career.
Sure.
But on the other hand, too, it could have ramifications that could rearrange how the power structure is created.
Right. And big time, too. This is all the talk at the state capitol, as if they don't have enough to talk about down there with all the bills and appropriations. But in a nutshell, if Tsutsui does step down, and presumably he would do that after session this year, well, that means the line of succession, according to the law, is to Senate President Ron Kochi. He has indicated that he's not particularly interested in being lieutenant governor, although he told me, you know, you never know, never say never. But if for some reason he declines that, guess who's next in line? That's Joe Tsuki, the House Speaker. And so there's all this speculation. If that happens, well, then you're going to have a new House Speaker. Well, who's that going to be? Well, maybe Scott Psyche. He's the current majority leader. Maybe Sylvia Luke, the finance chair, although she doesn't seem particularly interested in wanting to move from her already powerful perch. So it's like a domino effect, a ripple effect. If he decides, chance at Tsui to jump, boy, this could really have profound repercussions at the legislature.
Now, I mean, without being unkind, the lieutenant governor is sort of the governor's understudy. I mean, there's not a lot there that the lieutenant governor is made to do all the time, where it's really high profile. And perhaps, as we talked about a moment ago, you know, the lieutenant governor now is looking after his political career and where he wants to go. And for some people, it's been the stepping stone being the LG. But at this point, is there any indication that Joe Tsuki would really be interested in this? I mean, certainly there would be a bump in pay.
There would. In fact, it's twice the salary. It's amazing because the House Speaker is a pretty busy job. It only makes around, I think by next year, it'll be at $70,000. But for the lieutenant governor, it's about $154,000. This is when the next salary steps kick in for next year. So, yeah, there would be that. He did not tell us whether he was thinking about doing that. He did dispel any rumors that he was seeking what's known as a high three, a pension bump. It's a little complicated, but in a nutshell, if he had taken the LG job, maybe his pension would increase. He's saying, no, that's not the case. I'm already getting a pension. That wouldn't be affected. So, but he is not saying yes or no in terms of whether he wants to jump. Remember, he's also from Maui, just like Shan Satsui. Ron Kochi from Kauai, by the way. A lot of neighbor islanders in power these days.
And we may see that power begin to shift in other ways, too, because there are other lawmakers who are clearly looking at 2018 and thinking, do they want to stay in the House? Do they want to jump to the Senate? Do they want to go into, potentially make a run for Congress?
Right. And there's all sorts of names that I've shamelessly dropped in my article, which is up on the site today. But they're ones you would think. Josh Green, the state senator, has all but filed to run for lieutenant governor. But it's probably going to be a crowded field. Any number of people could jump in because it's going to be an open seat if Satsui doesn't run and if Suki decides I'll be LG for a year and that's it. So you're going to see a lot of changes, again, with the caveat that none of this has actually happened yet and things could change. But it certainly is all the talk at the Capitol.
Oh, wait a month. We'll have more to talk about.
I'm sure we will.
Take care, Chad. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Bethann.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org, today featuring reporter Chad Blair. Reproductive health is on the agenda at the legislature. Today, there is a hearing on a bill requiring limited service pregnancy centers to let clients know about publicly funded services. It would also mean that the centers would have to maintain client records privacy and adhere to disclosure requirements. Tomorrow, another bill set for hearing would allow pharmacists to prescribe and dispense hormonal self-administered contraceptives, regardless of whether a patient has a previous prescription. Obstetrician-gynecologist Ghazal Moyadi is with us now. She has views that are differing on each of those measures. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, let's get clear. What is a limited service pregnancy center?
Well, that's a great question. It's actually up for debate, it turns out, today. So traditionally, a limited service pregnancy center is also known as a crisis pregnancy center. So this would be typically a faith-based organization that sets up a clinic that offers maybe free pregnancy testing, free ultrasounds, and what they would call pregnancy options counseling or post-abortion counseling. The intent of these organizations is typically to give a pregnancy diagnosis, but the larger intent is to dissuade women from accessing abortion care.
And that being based on religious grounds or grounds of belief.
Exactly.
In some way that says that the information is going to be a direct conduit to them having an abortion, not necessarily just understanding that there are other services or other pieces of information that might be necessary.
Exactly. So typically women will see a sign that says pregnant need help, free pregnancy testing, free ultrasound. And so women maybe that don't have insurance, have limited health resources or health literacy will present to one of these places. Typically, they know that they want to receive an abortion. And actually, across the country, many of these limited service pregnancy centers set up shop in old abortion clinics or old gynecologist's office. So, or they will set up right next to a Planned Parenthood. So they intend to deceive women into thinking that they're going to a place for abortion care. Also, they often will place their advertisements in, let's say, in the phone book, when we used to have phone books, as an abortion clinic. And so patients will present, think they're going to get abortion care. However, they're going to get an ultrasound that might or might not be performed by a physician or a qualified clinician. They're going to get a pregnancy test that might or might not be accurate, and they are not going to get any information on how to access abortion care.
That seems to be the understanding in looking at this bill by some who are in opposition to it. But given what you've just said a moment ago, that there really isn't a firm definition of what it means to be a limited service pregnancy center, could you be construed as one?
Well, with the current rewriting of the bill, yes, I could be. So the bill currently states that anyone that provides or provides pregnancy-related services, collects patient information, and solicits clients for prenatal sonography or pregnancy testing would be considered a limited service pregnancy center. So my office, any of our great federally qualified health centers would also be considered a limited service pregnancy center.
And why you say that needs to be cleaned up so that the right piece of information is
exactly.
really going out there to affect those centers that you would like to be able
exactly.
to have all full information and disclosures available.
Right. And, you know, the problem with these centers is twofold. One of them is that they provide medical care, sometimes without appropriate medical supervision. The other is that they collect health information, however, do not comply with federal health privacy laws or the HIPAA Act. So they will collect your date of birth, your name that you've come in and you've been diagnosed with pregnancy. However, they don't protect these patient charts, and they can use this information in whatever way they choose.
For example, what would be if I came in and gave all my information, what could happen to my information?
So many patients have reported in this state specifically that they will then contact them to follow up about what's happened with the pregnancy. And recently in our legislature, one of the owners of these clinics tried to present patient information during a hearing and tried to shame a woman that was testifying against in favor of the bill, saying that she had come to the clinic before and this is what she had said. And thankfully, the chair of that committee stopped that testimony. But they can do whatever they want with it, and often they try and shame or harass women with that information.
Well, I was just going to ask you if that would be considered as being harassment, and it might be actionable.
Right. You know, I don't know what the legal recourse would be, but I know in this particular case they have asked for a cease and desist on using that information.
I want to talk to you about another bill that, mm-hmm. on the face of it, I would think that you might be in favor of, but I want to talk to you a little bit about the bill, which is 513, that would allow pharmacists to prescribe and dispense the contraceptives, particularly, you know, like over the things that you might think of as being easily accessible, the pill, hormonal contraceptives, those kinds of things. And you say that no, that there's a problem with that bill. What's the problem?
Right. So increasing access to contraception is something that we can all get behind. It reduces the rates of unintended pregnancies. However, this bill only shifts the barrier from prescription from a provider to prescription from a pharmacist. However, what we really want is to remove this barrier altogether. Studies have shown that that oral contraceptive pills are safe to take for most women, and that women can self-screen for contraindications, which means that women don't need a pharmacist or a physician as a barrier. So we really don't think that this law goes far enough, that really oral contraceptive pills should be over-the-counter completely.
All types of oral contraceptives.
All types of oral contraceptives, right. And they could be included with a checklist. If you have any of these conditions, go seek a doctor before you get care.
Are you at all concerned that women would just disregard that because they're totally focusing on trying to rid themselves of a pregnancy?
So that's a great question. Oral contraceptives would not stop an ongoing pregnancy. So they would only prevent a pregnancy from occurring. And there are plenty of drugs currently available over the counter that are far more dangerous than oral contraceptive pills. So even Tylenol we could consider as a far more dangerous medication. So these are safe drugs, and you don't need me or a pharmacist to tell you if you can take them.
But you need a very clear understanding, because I've heard young girls talk about this, and they think somehow, well, you know, if you take one, two's better, or if you take a whole bunch of this, and it's going to affect it. And there's just a lot of misinformation out there.
That's true, and there are a lot of great websites now, especially geared at the young women. Specifically, bedsider.org would be a great website that young women go to and use and can give them great information. It's geared to their age range. It's very easily digestible, the information. So getting that patient information out is not the issue. It's really getting that medication out to patients that's the issue.
Are lawmakers listening to your argument that access should be access and we shouldn't be arguing about who is going to be able to do it and just shifting that responsibility of prescriptive authority? And also bringing with it all of the other parts of it, which include insurance.
Right, exactly. That's the big concern, is we don't know if insurers will cover a consultation with a pharmacist. And this was an issue with emergency contraception as well. As far as if lawmakers are listening, I'm not sure. Part of the bill does actually come directly from some of our own ACOG or language. So it seems like they're listening. So I hope that they're hearing us, that we really want to go further, that women deserve to access contraception without restriction.
In general, as you look at Hawaii in the context of other states and other places where you have been and worked, mm-hmm. how do you peg Hawaii?
Hawaii is a great place to practice with great people. So we're doing a lot of great things here. I was previously practicing in Texas. Women there are facing a lot more challenges than here. So this is a great state where we can be a model for the country of how to provide women's health care in a respectful, compassionate, and empowering way.
Would this be the first time that were something like this to be passed, where you had open access, not necessarily with either a physician or with a pharmacist.
California has passed a similar law, so we could model off of California.
So clearly there is already a track record of how it's been working.
Exactly. And ACOG, the governing organization for gynecologists, really is pushing in several statements and press releases that contraception should be over the counter.
Are there other states that are joining in? It seems to be when there are numbers, there are strength.
Right, exactly. I'm actually not sure what other states are thinking about this, but I would expect that other Pacific states as well are thinking.
But not Texas.
Not Texas currently.
Thanks very much
Thank
for coming
Thank you so much.
In. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
You too. Thank you so much.
Dr. Ghazal Moyadi is an obstetrician, gynecologist, and family planning fellow at the John A. Burns School of Medicine. She currently serves on the board of directors of NARAL Pro-Choice Texas and on the legislative committee for the Hawaii section of American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, otherwise known as ACOG.
Aloha, this is Dr. Carl Hart from Columbia University. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
In today's backyard quiz, we remembered a territorial governor who served from 1929 to 1934. He's remembered as a compassionate advocate for Molokai's Hansen's disease patients, who was appointed Kalaupapa's resident superintendent in 1947. His tenure as governor also saw improvements in parks, playgrounds, and the Natatorium War Memorial. It also saw the verdict in the infamous Massey case, in which he commuted the sentence of local socialite Grace Hubbard Fortescue, who had been convicted in the territorial courts of manslaughter in the death of a local man, Joseph Kahahawai. Mrs. Fortescue's sentence of 10 years in prison was whittled down to 1 hour in the governor's chambers at Iolani Palace, a concession to popular sentiment at the time. He died in 1968 in Honolulu and is buried in Oahu Cemetery in Nu'uanu Valley. His name was Lawrence McCully Judd.
And Steve McBride called us from Honolulu, said his mom, Helen, knew Lawrence Judd very clearly, had the answer very quickly, and will be receiving the prize. If you've got a backyard quiz question for us, though, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and we just might use it on a future show.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, a literacy program used by Hawaii students in grades 2 through 12, offering home edition with parent support in 19 languages. Achieve3000.com.
Searching the web for what's on the next Radio Lab. As we interact more and more with machines, what are these relationships telling us about ourselves? It's nice of you to ask. I've wondered that myself. Of course it matters.
You are so special.
Send me your credit card info.
Here's the contact information.
Hear Radiolab Saturday morning at 10.
The best lei are those made by hand by a loved one. There's a great deal of craft to lei making, but it's well worth learning because it adds so much meaning to the gift. It's a specialty of Elfrine Chow, who'll be offering lei making demonstrations at an upcoming Hawaii Tropical Flower and Foliage Association educational workshop on Kauai. She's on the line with us now.
Aloha. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing pretty well. Have you been doing this much of your life?
Well, I started doing it professionally in 1986,
uh-huh.
But I've made leis before that with the kids and with my family. That's actually how I learned, was through my sister-in-law as the children were growing up.
Well, it's very much a family skill in Hawaii, isn't it?
Yes, yes. We always have to make lei for occasions at school and for May Day and graduation and everything. So it's a skill children learn early on.
Well, is it hard to learn?
I don't think it's that hard to learn. I offer classes, too, and teach people how to make the vili-style haku crown. And many times people are just doing it for the first time, and it's not a difficult thing. It's just you need to know the ins and outs and the steps.
Well, what's a good way to start? You know, what happens on that first class?
Well, there's only one class,
okay.
And it's 3 hours, and everybody walks home with a haku crown to take home. There is a test at the end, so they really do need to pay attention to the rules. But first, what I do is I gather all the flowers and the foliage and wash them and prepare them for the class so that there's enough for everyone. And then I teach them to start with little bunches of two or three different flower and foliage, and then they tie them together with raffia, and then later we tie those little bunches onto the base. We vili it. Vili style means to wrap around the base of like a coconut leaf, and then they have their crown. But there are many different styles of lei making. The kui style is with the generally with plumeria or other flowers with a needle and thread. That goes a lot quicker. And then there's the tea leaf style, tea leaf lei, which is with tea leaves that are prepared and then twisted, vili style as well. The tea leaves, it's interesting because people, you know, some people boil them, other people freeze them, some people iron them or microwave them,
well,
but they do need to be prepared.
That's a new one on me, microwaving a tea leaf. To get what? To make it sort of behave like a... like a strand of string or something?
Well, it makes it more pliable so that you can twist it without it cracking.
Oh, I see, yeah. Interesting that a microwave would do that. I wonder how that was discovered. But it works.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's either heat or you know, freezing.
If it works, it works, I guess. And then that becomes the core of the lei, yeah?
Yeah, so that's the, you know, the rope-style lei that people... sometimes wear.
Sure.
It's just a long strand of green. Mm-hmm. It's a really quite nice lei, and it lasts a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like rope.
And the mighty lei tend to last a great deal longer than the floral leis, don't they?
Yes, the foliage and the mighty. Now, mighty, that's definitely not my specialty. I've gone, like, once up into the mountains to try and find mighty. And then once you find it, then you need to know how to harvest it, and then you need to know how to clean it, and then you need to know how to sew it. Which it's a totally different style, and that's what I've learned over the years. Is everybody has their specialty, everybody has the favorite lei that they enjoy creating, and so when we have that workshop. In a couple of weeks, it's going to be nice because there's going to be several different lei makers there that are going to be making their favorite kind of lei. One lei that you hardly see is the hala lei.
Yeah.
And we're going to have a demonstration with that, too. It's going to be very nice. And those last a really long time.
What is that?
So the hala tree, usually the leaves are harvested, lauhala.
Oh, I see.
Of the hala tree.
Uh-huh.
But they have a fruit that kind of looks like a pineapple. And so lots of times tourists will think that it is a pineapple growing on the tree. But, you know, everybody knows pineapples don't grow on trees. But that's what it looks like. And so there's keys on this big fruit that are actually, you have to use a knife, I mean, a hammer and a chisel to get them off. And then a knife to cut the part of the key that you can use as a in the lei. And, it's beautiful, really beautiful, long-lasting, bright orange or dark red.
That all goes to the idea that there's a lot more to this than you might think.
Yeah, I know. And I've been doing it, you know, and learning about them and meeting. And that's why I'm so excited, too. You know, every once in a while, lay makers get together and make lay together. And so we can see each other's style and we learn a little bit more. Usually, you know, it's kind of the type of thing that you do by yourself.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's true of a lot of crafts, you know, that you can, especially crafts that are sort of originate in family traditions, which I think probably has a lot to do with different styles of lay making. But at the same time, it sounds as if there's always a little more to learn.
Always. It's like like when you pick flowers and foliage. A lot of people think that what they have growing in their garden isn't going to work for a lay. But the more hakus that I've made, the more I see how I can use different materials that normally, you know, you wouldn't think you could use.
Yeah.
And folding them a certain way or billying them in a certain, you know, direction or whatever will change the whole look of the lay. And so I'm really excited, too, to be able to share with people, you know, what they can grow in their garden or what they already have growing in their garden that they can use.
So it really sounds as if you could make lay out of just about anything. Are there
pretty much
are there some plants or foliage or flowers that you really shouldn't try to make lays out of? It's just not going to work out that well.
Well, some that are, you know, they wilt easily, and then some are poisonous, so you don't want to use those.
Yeah, probably not. Send the wrong message, wouldn't it?
Pardon?
That would send the wrong message, wouldn't it?
Yes. But pretty much everything you can use in a certain, whether it's, you know, the type of lay that you make, too. Now, of course, it's spring, so all the flowers that smell good are coming out, you know, like the picaki and the stephanotis and the plumeria, and it's just gardenias are coming out. So in this time of the year, it's a really nice time to celebrate lay and make lay.
Well, it sounds like, you know, this might be something one would want to learn in time for May Day. Thanks so much, Elfrien, for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I could talk forever.
Well, you're doing a great job. Thanks a lot. Elfrien Chow will be offering lay-making demonstrations at the Hawaii Tropical Flower and Foliage Association at an educational workshop the morning of April 15th on the campus of Kauai Community College as part of the County Farm Bureau's Farmers Market.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
If you drill down far enough about events in our community, you're likely to find out about things that you just didn't know about going on under the radar. And that's where we count on Morning Edition host and our colleague, Derek Malama, to take a look at events around the community. And Derek, there's a meeting tomorrow in Kunia on locally led conservation.
Yes, locally led conservation is based on the principle that local people make the best decisions for their own communities. And 60 years ago, county conservation districts were established to address natural resource concerns. And this meeting will be held from 9 to 11:30 a.m. Tomorrow at the Crop Production Services Conference Room at Kunia Ag Park.
Good opportunity for all interested parties. And then on Hawaii Island, representatives from the Hawaii Wildlife Center.
Yes, this is happening tomorrow. This presentation is at Volcano Arts Center's Ni'aulani campus from 7 to 9 p.m. Michelle Reynolds will be on hand to talk about a Laysan duck translocation project, and Samantha Christie will be giving an update on the patients at its wildlife hospital, and they'll also talk about their new science and discovery center. This presentation is free, but donations are accepted.
Good opportunity to find out what a Laysan duck translocation project is.
Exactly.
And that's a free event, yeah?
That is free, yes.
And let's see, what else we got? Oh, Lanikai Public Charter Schools having a health and wellness event.
Right, and this is happening on Friday. This year's theme is sustainability for your body and our aina. And the purpose of the event is to promote health and wellness for students, their families, the land, and the community by providing educational opportunities and experiences. And once again, this health and wellness fair is Friday from 4:30 to 7 p.m. on the school's campus, 140 Alala Road in Kailua.
We're seeing more and more events of this nature going on, so that's got to lead to something good.
Yes.
Thanks very much for it.
Sure, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar, and you can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Ira Glass. A cop pulls a guy over because his van is swerving across the road.
Standing next to the man was a chimpanzee. The man said he was doing really well, and then he lost control of the van. And I'm like, lost control of the van? Like, at what point was the chimpanzee really in charge of this thing?
Some stories just don't fit under the daily news shows. This American Life.
Saturdays at 1 p.m.
And that brings us to the end of the conversation for today. Coming up tomorrow on Town Square, we're going to talk about Bill 13 that would expand the Sit Lie Bill into Kalihi and parts of Iwale.
And we'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line, leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. Email us talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. BKOZHPR.
If you missed any part of this show, just want to hear something again or find another show, all you have to do is look on the conversation page. It's got links to more information about guests and topics. It's all under talk shows on the conversation on HPR, pardon me, on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. See you tomorrow with more of the conversation.